Only again. He stood in line abreast, a hist inside, billowing at the trousers stinking. Open air affairs, floodlit, hailstones rattled into the front of a bare stand. Just a few pissed off fans linger in the lee of the gents, knocked out by underdogs. Fuming to no one, imagine 6-0 at home. The boss will have to consider his position. Hanging from lampposts, lost election candidates outlasting the storm. I think most of the posters are gone now, but what about the cable ties? Who'll take those now? So this was going back a bit, and it's called Election Literature Campaign. When you cast your vote at the poll, to hinder you reach your decision, take note who's high on the pole, so remote above all our derision. Everyone sees without glamour or glitter, so by degrees remove your own litter. When the votes are all cast and those boxes secured, or by electronics at last, your choices are lured. Quaint keys for both walker and sitter, summer breeze, remove your old litter. All tall posters are gone, removed with great zeal, but sun and moon shone on ties plastic and real. Time, please, drink up your last litter. Moment, seize, remove your old litter. For hundreds of years, without posters for minding, to poles, sides and rears, will ties still be binding? Don't sneeze or cause any titter. Avoid sleaze, remove your old litter. By slashing and reaping, rip down ugly ties, without stilts or leaping halfway to low skies. Clamping knees, feeling so much fitter, tightly squeeze, remove your old litter. See if your work has marred streets with plastic wreaths. Volunteers who work so hard for you end your noble deeds. Ignore fleas and all statue splitter. Use dungarees, remove your old litter. Are all posters needed to inform, or merely sport to pass the time? When will lampposts return to norm, not scene of environmental crime? No to niece, don't be such a quitter. Yes, be nice, remove your old litter. On country road or city street, posts and poles which carry lots of wires and cables clipped so neat are so defaced with ugly blocks. Tall trees needed just one giant critter, yet ease to remove your old litter. Accepted and useful are plastic ties when properly used in garden or cable. Several colours and more than one size, remove from small limbs we aren't able. Don't freeze, there's no time to fritter. Fully arise, remove your old litter. When all the litter is gone, improvements many we'll see. But next canvas will be done with posters again, high as can be. After cheese, hire some heavy hitter. Or in trees, remove your old litter. When for choices you have to search to maintain your true line of vision, take note who's high on the perch, far over circumspecting incision. Don't tease, no laughter or skitter. Oh, jeez, remove your old litter.
Thanks, Seamus. Next up to the mic is Paddy Doyle.
This poem was written in homage to rock on Myrtleville Beach. Wet from the waves, you shimmer in the warming sun. The glimmer in your eye is a sea urchin opening and closing in its own socket-sized ocean. A seagull circles and lands on your shoulder. Your eye becomes still as a mirror, a sea urchin cowering in the eye of its beholder. You are privy to the deepest secrets of this place, its entire history encoded in the lines on your face. small wonder you stand with such pies and such grace, unmoved by the tide going out, unmoved by the tide coming in, lean out over the ocean forever and never fall in.
Thanks, Paddy. Next up is David Rowe.
About a painting that hangs in a museum in Massachusetts by Kandinsky, and a critic once said that Kandinsky's paintings were so rigorous they were like a mathematical proof. So I've written this poem as a proof. Kandinsky's untitled number 629, with a shout out to homeless Navy vet Scott Lee. Let A not equal A, and given that the dame whose name I don't deign to recall, no, not at all, is the subtext of this text, just as death is the subtext of all life. It follows that rather than kowtow to any upstart joyriding question mark, and the spiteful kite fights of Good Friday, the horizon done called in sick with a chartreuse hangover. And if and only if a heart heavier far than an ibis feather belies a Buster Keaton-esque Googleplex of operatic bric-a-brac, then and only then is the feasibility of falling the fuck apart in a manner at once transcendental and derby-hatted demonstrated. QED, baby. Some of you know I'm here from New Orleans, and this here is Louis Armstrong's Satchel Mouth poem with thanks to Ken Burns. With breath and brass, he swings gut bucket alchemy and hands us back jasmine perfume of Storyville whores. Hemi-demi semi-quavers a dizzy my country tis of thee, pumping his cornet of pistons as if milking the overflowing udders of exuberance utterly dry. His cornucopian horn, his kitchen sink a pated genius, proclamate an emancipation for the rest of us. A bowler hat to mute another as below, so above, so low, so that he conflates anatomy and astronomy and herniates the heavens before laughing a teardrop from his trumpet spit duct onto the wore-out dance floor. Thank you.
Next up to the mic is Miriam Casey.
The game. Down the back streets of Amsterdam we slunk, pursuing the lurid trail of teasing twilight and half-naked voodoo dolls. The bloodlights lavishly nurtured the scent of flora and sweat and fauna of the creeping carbon jungle. As we breathed in the fumes of hushed Siberia, safe behind the glass cages, the big game set their weapons calmly. Here, the land lies still upon the hill of a barrow breast that shoulders rocks of pay. But here, will the bird sing again and again and again.
Thanks, Miriam. Next up is Rosie.
This is one I wrote a while back, and it's kind of inspired by one of friends on Facebook, read about his mom, and I can relate to that. So it's been in my dad for some reason, so I'll share that with you for my dad. You lie there in the bed, eyes sunken, the lines of your face drawn soft and close to your skull. Tonight I realize that you can see your fading reflection in the mirror, constantly. I wanted to cover it, for you not to be reminded of what you are, constantly. The face of death encroaching. You lie there helpless. I sit by your side, defeated. Your mind wandering makes dreams of waking nightmares of days. Confusion overlays everything. The past clings to soothe the present, not salved. And I fight this urge for you not to see me cry. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosie. Next up, we have Niall McCarthy.
This is not autobiographical in any way. Southbound on Route 15. Schoolgirls, psychos, homeless, tweakers, college students, blue collars, stoners, drunks, hoes, pimps, suits, and schoolboys. That pretty much describes the people I hang with from 7:40 to 8:05 on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings. Welcome to my world, the southbound bus on 15th Avenue from Bethany Home Road to Thomas Road. It's my personal hell, what I endure to get to my classes at Phoenix College. The gates to my hell open right when I get to the bus stop at 7:30 a.m. Without fail, I am greeted by an assortment of litter, leftovers from McDonald's, cartons and wrappers, empty cigarette boxes, tissues, gum, diapers with their exposed treasures, and sometimes vomit or even a used condom. I hope that's bird shit. I'm beginning to recognize some of my fellow travelers. White trash boy, with his infected acne, oozing cold sores and missing tooth. Prissy, fat girl in her school uniform and tragic hemline. Mr. Discount Auto Repair, carrying his toolbox, smoking like a professional. Greasy hands, crusty fingers, and broken fingernails. Crazy old lady constantly mumbling to herself, not a tooth in her head, wrinkled and lost, or maybe just left behind. And then, worst of all, three fresh-faced, 20-something Pakistani boys. Crisp white shirts, trendy gay ties, blue tailored suits, and backpacks. They never talk to each other because they're too busy playing with their iPhones. Bastards. Then there's me, Diva Girl 602, a superstar talent, a sharp intellect, astoundingly beautiful, curvy, charismatic, a humanitarian who loves everybody and is loved by all. Diva Girl 602, trapped inside this 17-year-old skinny, underdeveloped body, painfully aware of her flat chest, her zits, her period, and the cramps that have been with her for the last 26 hours. Diva Girl 602, Holly Clark, in your face. After an eternity of waiting for the bus, it's here, oh joy. When it's my turn, I climb the three steps and put the card in the reader. The overweight, sweaty, lecherous bus driver leers at me, pervert. The bus is busy. Please God, don't make me have to stand. Please God, don't make me have to sit next to anybody. Please, oh God, oh God, oh God. The bus stinks this morning. Oil and diesel. Sweat, vomit, urine, cigarettes, and bad breath. I hope my seat isn't wet. I guess I'll know pretty soon. White trash boy is sitting behind me coughing. Prissy fat girl is standing over me, eyeing him. Gross. Mr. Discount Auto Repair is chatting with DJ Ugly, a precocious stoner who has the most disgusting dreadlocks imaginable. Even the flies are repulsed. Unclean, unwashed, uncouth, unhealthy. Unbearable. With the brakes screeching, we come to a slow stop at the crosswalk. The uncomfortable waiting to get going again is broken when the bus driver puts his hands in the air. He clicks his fingers and shouts, "Let's get this party started." As he stands and turns to us, the windows go completely black. For a moment, we're in complete darkness. It's broken by a spotlight shining on our bus driver, who is now dressed like Sergeant Pepper. A black military tunic decorated with gold tassels, gold turnbacks, gold braidings, and gold epaulettes and gold shoulder braids. This military outfit certainly wasn't meant for battle, unless it was for a stage wrestling bout between he and Donatelli Versace. He stares at me and smiles the broadest and brightest smile. His gold tooth sparkles like a blister in the midday sun. He has transformed himself, reinvented himself. He is endearing. He is sly. He is my soulmate. DJ Ugly has taken his rightful place at the turntable and has appeared at the center doors. His dreadlocks are now effervescent. His hair sparkles like cut crystal. He chooses the perfect song, "We Are Family" by Sister Sledge. The three Pakistani guys immediately take to the floor. They peel off their suits and reveal ostentatious diamond-encrusted leather thongs. They wear them well. They grind on the stripper poles beneath their disco balls. Crazy old lady smiles an excited but gummy smile and places a dollar bill in the thong of one of the guys. He is wearing a fabulous leopard print push-up, triangle top swimsuit with a side string bottom. Classy outfit. Mr. Discount Auto Repair opens his toolbox and pulls out a trumpet which he plays with reckless abandon, making the song "We Are Family" richer than ever. He plays and dances up and down the bus, moving this way and that, avoiding White Trash Boy and Prissy Fat Girl, who are dancing together like their lives depended on it. They're dancing like superstars. What a way to start the day. When the bus finally comes to a stop, I can't help myself but giggle as I pass the three Pakistani boys who are still playing with their iPhones. "You guys looked better when you were playing on the stripper poles," I thought to myself. "What was all that, Holly Clark? What was all that, Diva Girl 602? Where did that come from? Time to straighten up. Time to get into student mode. Time to get to my Mountain Dew, the breakfast that takes you higher. Enough with Sergeant Pepper uniforms, enough leather diamond-encrusted thongs, and enough leopard print push-up triangle top swimsuits. It's time to get to class. Time to settle to my desk. Time to focus. I wonder what my professors will be wearing today." Thank you.
Thanks, Niall. I don't know whether to be worried about you or in awe. next to my big grin.
Hello. I'd like to do something which is just going, taking a step back about sound. Where I'm coming from, instead of just coming just straight from feeling, I like to, you're still shaping your sounds with meaning. So if someone gives me a meaning I don't understand, if someone could give me a Gaelic word.
Amor.
Lee. Amora. but kind of I'm interested also to share a little bit where we are, 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 where am I, where are we, here, where we are. There's a lot of synchronicity in what I said in the language I speak English. It's strange, like words are quite close to each other when you're purely in a space of toning. From the space of pure atonement, pure resonance, words are very close to each other. This is like, I mean, I get very scientific. I'm going to get a little bit scientific over here. I get really scientific and really mental, which is really left brain and really linguistic. And I've got this mind that wants to explain things scientifically, and I'd like you to get that bit as well. I'd like to let you indulge my left mind, because the left mind is very ugly. The left mind is a language mind. It's very scientific. We've only been in it for 10, 20,000 years, and yet it's taken over our lives. And yet the government's analogous to it. The way we think for the government's so insensitive, doesn't understand what playing field is for, doesn't understand anything about the right brain. And you're all poets, and you know,
and feeling, and pure resonance is where all words are close to each other. And it's so lovely to be able to find where everything's close to everything else. And I have this way of doing it, which is kind of like croaking. It's very beautiful if
you're a singer. I don't know if you're a singer, but when you're a singer, it's really hard to come. It's like when I start singing, I'm coming from one place, and it's so close to another place. It's like the it's so amazing how words are so close to each other, because everything is all really, when you get from like a zero, everything's all in the same place. Everything is all the zero. And the sun, the zero sun. You can all do the zero sun, please. So it's so useful to find yourself come together. And then again, if you want to put the one in then, it's a really powerful one. Brings your guts. Instead of trying to come from your heart, trying to come from a sincere place, it's so hard, isn't it? Because the more you think about it, the more you differentiate into a million fractured eyes. And to bring all those fractured eyes together, you go, oh, it's quite good. It's musicated again. But it's so... I musicated a dive, and I loved it when we were all in a big zero together. Yeah. But just a suggestion to switch between the musication of the zero and the actual saying something. Everything I say is about nothing. But when you get so much about nothing, everything comes into that nothing. And then it's nice to then differentiate you are. It's straight to the horse. So I'd like it all to for you all to think, oh, you know, I'm not a singer, or I'm not, there's all these little spaces inside ourselves, so this is a wonderful tool for integrating all these little eyes. It does it vocally, but you know. Can we all do that? And then, I'll get another Gaelic word from way over there. Got a Gaelic word way over at the back.
Slipperna. Oh,
okay. We can aim for that in the end, maybe. But this is, we decided we want to come out of the
zero. Matara.
Or even start there, actually, Schlimmerna. But let all the breath out of it. So all to get to zero, you can take any word and just let the breath out. Schlimmerna. Can you try that? Because you're always talking. Can you try and take the breath out of it?
What do we do? I want to be one of the Schlimmerna.
Schlimmerna.
Schlimmerna. Schlimmerna. Schlimmerna. Schlimmerna.
Lighting words. Lighting words. Just don't cruddle me for a couple of minutes on Schlubber down. I'm put some power in. No breath at all. No sound. You can hear it. Don't hear yourself. And you let the sound in, it's strong. never got to, I couldn't hear what everyone was doing, but it's still not nothing. You can draw it, you can draw it as well. It's like you throw like a zero here. It's a cylinder. And you're touching all the mandala of your possible selves.
The man with that hat is the amazing Joe Sweeney.
This is another little extract from a ghost story that I'm writing. It's called Aunt Emily's Secret, and it's about two boys whose parents have been killed in a car crash. And they're on their way to stay with Aunt Emily, as they believe. And they have nightmares about seeing their parents, and this is just a description of one of the nightmares that the narrator has. On another occasion, I see my father returning to my mother at the gate and talking to her, as if explaining to her that he tried but was unable to get in. They appear to be talking for a time, and then she breaks down and he holds her, and after a long time they walk away together. They both half turn for a moment and beckon to me impatiently, wearily, as if they are tired of coming back every night. There is something odd in the whole situation. They are dressed as they were in the car, with light clothes on, as if they don't realize that it is a winter's night with the wind howling through the trees. They look as if we had made some plans to go walking down by the river as we used to do years ago, and I am delaying them. They look impatient, worried, as if they don't realize they are dead. Just before they disappear beneath the chestnut trees and down towards the river, I fumble frantically with the window latch, but by the time I get it open, they're gone, the garden desolate as a grave. A frightening howl of wind is all that greets me, leaping at me like a savage thing from the darkness. I go back to bed then, and this is where the nightmare really comes into its own. Because I discover that I can't get back into bed. And the reason I can't get back in, the most frightening thing of all, is that I am already there. I am still lying in the bed asleep. I haven't woken at all. I only dreamed I got up and went to the window. It is as if I have been loosed in a dream body, trying in my grief to be with my parents again, refusing to let them go. In another version of the dream, it's even more disturbing. I hear a knocking down at the front door. It starts gently, but gets louder, turning into an angry pounding. I hear voices murmuring outside. Then I hear what is more terrifying than anything of the pounding at the door below. A hand is rapping at the window pane in the upstairs bedroom. I am too afraid to leave the bed and pull the curtains back. God alone knows what I might see. The bodies of my parents floating up into the air, their pale knuckles knocking on the glass. No, I stay in the bed, and then I feel a draft on my face. Somehow, despite my fear, I get up and go to the window, only to find it has already been opened. I lean out and call down into the dark garden, and then start with fright as I hear a noise behind me in the room. I turn, and with heart pounding, I notice the bedroom door is ajar. Somehow I manage to cross the room. I move slowly, strangely, like I'm struggling through a swamp, and then very slowly, my mind begins to grasp what has happened. They have come in the window, across the bedroom and left by the door. I hear a creaking on the landing. I stop and listen. I think I hear a noise out on the stairs in the dark, but I can't be sure. It may just be the wind making a raft, even in the attic creak. I step closer to the open door, and then I hear something else. I hear voices murmuring downstairs. I slam the bedroom door shut in terror. Remain close to it, pressing my ear against it, wanting to hear, afraid to hear, in case I don't know what. I stand shivering my bare feet on the cold floor, the moonlight streaming through the window behind me. The voices from downstairs continue murmuring softly. Kind, worried voices from down in the big old kitchen. And then I hear a creak at the bottom of the stairs and a voice, an old, impatient voice from the past, whispering, "And what time do you think this is? What time do you think this is?" I get up, and with a courage that surprises and disturbs me, a courage that I feel is not quite natural to me, I open the bedroom door. Seeing the kitchen light is on downstairs, I walk out onto the landing, and the light below disappears abruptly. And the voices, oh, the voices break up and distort into high pitches, fleeing like frightened birds into the darkness, leaving only a ringing silence in their wake. I turn then, trying to get back into the bedroom, but the door is closed, and though I turn the handle, I cannot get back in. I beat on it with my hands and shout, but there is no sound. And then I see the figures moving up the stairs, dressed in white, reaching their hands towards me, like sharp metal fingers. None of this is really happening, I tell myself, it is just a dream. I'll just wait till it's over. My body is rigid as the metal hands reach towards me, pass into my chest, curl around my heart, clasp it, and then slowly take me step by step down the stairs into the strange glow coming from somewhere.
Okay, when I was being asked there for Irish words, there were thousands that could be given, and I remember there's a word in Dineen's dictionary which is Irvirat, which means the loneliness felt at cockcrow. And I'm not sure if there's any word in any other language. And there's a word in a Scottish Gaelic dictionary which is Shitagach, which means the sound that a stone wall makes just before it falls. And I don't think there's anything in any other language like that either. And as I mentioned, Scottish in this purple molded carnival that Paul produces for us, I'm going to read a very short translation of a poem from Scott Gaelic that I have done. I'll give the Scott Gaelic first and then the translation and then so on. It's called Glen. On Luigenus Glinge, the Geistoch, Russian Tornanish, the Ishkin Yarish, Yechmir Jalov, Ungantanig on Fuch and Wuss, and Krach the Hanig on Tanaisha, the Heathing of Chalish. In the loneliness of the Glen, listening to the thunder then, with the spring rain I tried to paint, but the cold came down, wild and bitter blown, like a snow that comes in the midst of the night, like the word from the mouth of a midden wife. And then last week, those of you who were privileged to hear me singing a parody of the Sisters of Mercy, I think on the same, this is not a song you'll be happy to hear, but on the same theme about the terrible abuse that was done to children in our schools. It's called And the Children Said. And the children said, "Speak to us of love." And the priest said in a firm voice, "God is love, repeat after me." And the children said, "Bog is dove." And the priest smote them and shouted, "God is love, repeat after me." And the children muttered, "Dog is glove." And the priest smote them yet again a second time and roared, "God is love, say it properly." And the children whispered, for verily they had a fear of the law, "Sod is stuff." And the priest did totally use his rag, and berated them and bait them until they could truly say that God was love. And the children carried this lesson with them in their hearts and on their outstretched hands and even unto their bare buttocks.
Thanks, Alan. We're almost to the end there. Would anyone else like to read before we wrap up? No? Okay, next the mic is Paul Casey.
Thanks. I was going to do a long one, but there's only 6 minutes left in the night, so I'm going to do you one that I wrote, which I'm not sure is a poem. It could be a poem. Just the other day, 4th November 1994. A summer sky, 2:30 p.m. Across the Lee, Finbar spire. Foreign tongues bounce off the glass, resigned ears settle. Number 73 above, beep. Rosie in the car. All 20 seats are full. The ticket machine is empty. Three prams, three teats, an edible spectacle case. Number 74 above, the inquiry sign. The use of cameras in this office is strictly forbidden. Please take a ticket and wait to be called. A lively young bearded Corkonian fills the machine with more numbers. Number 75 above. Number 76. I'm here because I forgot to sign on yesterday. The Africans and the Eastern Europeans have not done the same. Maybe soon we'll be able to sign on online. Enjoy the good weather. Number 77. A second hatch has opened up. Number 78, number 79. 40,000 Corkonians on the dole, they say. I guess 1 in 40,000 is something. But that's maybe 1/2 of the working population. Number 80, mountains of bright cumulus seem asleep beneath the sun. Number 81. Number 82, number 83 goes up in a shabby pinstripe suit. Number 84, one pram down, two to go. I try to locate the source origin of the African conversation behind me. Number 85. Number 86. Miss Purple Fingernails has left. The roller machine tongues out more numbers to a couple of well-dressed young lads. The air is relaxed with moodless conversations. Text messages float about. The recession has stayed outside in the sun. Number 87. Perambulator number 3 is pushed to the hatch. Darkened glass, dulls the civil interior. Out here, the global village thrums, threatens to overgrow. And I'm finished yet. The clerk here smiles patiently, easily, with answers to all the complications. They glance at the rest of us once in a while, listen carefully, and answer deftly, comprehensively. Number 88, a ponytail steps up in brown corduroy. Cool pole, all in black, saunters in smoothly. Number 89. I shift up to the end of the row of cool, perforated metal seats. Rosie reading Rushdie in the car. My noble-nosed Rosie, the regal Oregon, love of my days and nights. Number 90, 3:15 p.m. This is the last time I forget to sign on. This is the last time I forget to sign on. Maybe I'll get a normal job altogether, like collecting lights. Or mapping eye colour. One clerk leaves, doubling the weight, left Celtic football jersey. Number 91, number 92, number 93, 1523. Time to go. Aortic mix of spirit liquid has even evolved vampires overdosed on blends of rich thick contradiction of unraveled breaths expired, and even as muses pilgrim seasons muses each leave a trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, a new harvest of mystery, and even as starved poets sip to mountain manna purple poem wine, dream drunk poets, Paul Stephens descends purpley.